Morning News. I'm Christopher Cruz reporting. Iran is vowing to retaliate against the perpetrators of Wednesday's terror attack on a military convoy. At least 27 border soldiers from the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps were killed. Associated Press correspondent Charles de Ledesma reports.
A suicide bomber has targeted a bus in Iran's southeast, carrying personnel of the elite paramilitary Revolutionary Guard Force, killing and wounding dozens. There was no immediate claim of responsibility for the attack, which came on the day of a US-led conference in Warsaw that included discussions on what America describes as Iran's malign influence across the wider Mideast. The Guard Force is a major economic and military power in Iran, answerable only to the country's supreme leader, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei. I'm Charles Ledesma.
A former U.S. Air Force counterintelligence officer who defected to Iran 6 years ago has been charged with spying for the Iranian government. 39-year-old Monica Witt was indicted by a federal grand jury in Washington on charges of disclosing the code name and classified mission of a special U.S. military program to the Iranian government. Her actions, said one investigator, are a betrayal of our nation's security, our military, and the American people. A federal judge has found that former Trump campaign manager Paul Manafort intentionally lied to investigators and a federal grand jury in the Russia investigation. The judge said in an order that there's sufficient evidence that Manafort lied in breach of his plea agreement. The decision hurts Manafort's chances of receiving a reduced sentence next month. Manafort remains jailed while he is awaiting sentencing. He was accused of lying about sharing polling data, among other things. This is VOA News. As Congress works on finalizing a bill that would keep the government running into the weekend, they're keeping an eye on the White House as well. AP Washington correspondent Sagar Magani reports from the White House.
Trump says he'll be looking for landmines in the bill from Congress, which he has yet to see. He indicated, however, he is pleased with preliminary figures in the border security deal worked out by a committee of Republicans and Democrats, but says the opposition party is being stingy when it comes to funding for the wall.
We're building a lot of wall right now with money that we already have.
Trump also tells reporters he does not want to see another partial shutdown of the U.S. government, saying that would be a terrible thing. Steve Herman, VOA News, at the White House.
The Democrat-controlled House rebuked President Trump Wednesday, voting to cut off U.S. military assistance to the Saudi coalition fighting in Yemen. The vote was 248-177. Was one of the only times the House has ever used the War Powers Act, which was passed in 1973 after the disastrous involvement of American forces in Vietnam. It gives Congress the authority to pull American forces out of an undeclared war. The measure now goes to the Senate, which passed a similar measure before the 2018 midterm elections. That sets up a possible showdown with the White House. The American Embassy in Lebanon says the United States has delivered laser-guided rockets valued at more than $16 million to the Lebanese army. In a landmark vote, Australian lawmakers have made it easier for sick refugees held offshore to be treated in the country. It's the first time in almost 80 years that a government has lost a vote on its own legislation in the lower house of parliament. Correspondent Phil Mercer reports for VOA from Sydney.
The legislation will give doctors a greater say on which refugees detained offshore can travel to Australia for medical treatments. Since 2013, Canberra has held asylum seekers arriving by boat in camps on the tiny Republic of Nauru and on Manus Island in Papua New Guinea in the South Pacific, and has insisted they would never be allowed to resettle in Australia. Doctors have said medical facilities on the islands are inadequate for about 1,000 asylum seekers and refugees who remain.
President Trump and Colombia's President Iván Duque met Wednesday in the White House to talk about efforts to push Venezuela's leftist president Nicolas Maduro from power. Duque told Trump at the beginning of the meeting, "We want to put an end to the brutal dictatorship in Venezuela." You can find more on these and other late-breaking and developing stories from around the world, around the clock, at voanews.com and on the VOA News mobile app. I'm Christopher Cruz, VOA News.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Thursday, February 14th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Kenyan President Kenyatta has given striking nurses until this Friday to return to work or be fired.
Any nurse who fails to report to work as directed above will be dismissed by the county governments and the Ministry of Health.
Nigerian youth are urged to show their numbers in Saturday's presidential election. There's a debate in Malawi about the English proficiency of one of the ruling party's vice presidential candidates. A captain is the first to confess before Gambia's ongoing Truth and Reconciliation Commission hearings. And this week, Cameroon charged Maurice Kamto, the man who claimed he won last year's election.
The government is charging him with a couple of ridiculous charges, I will say. The first is rebellion. The second is hostility à la patrie, or hostility to the fatherland.
That's Professor Patrice Ngana, head of the campaign to free Maurice Kamto. And global unemployment reaches its lowest level in a decade. Those stories plus our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta has ordered striking nurses at public hospitals to end their ongoing strike and resume work by tomorrow Friday, or risk being fired. The president's ultimatum comes as clinical and laboratory officers have also threatened to join striking nurses over the government's failure to honor a collective bargaining agreement by county governments. Maureen Ojiambo reports from Nairobi.
Speaking after meeting with the Council of Governors representatives in State House Nairobi, President Uhuru Kenyatta said that the striking nurses are interfering with his agenda to Kenyans of ensuring universal health care for all. Kenyatta has given the governors the mandate to fire the striking nurses for having paralyzed the health services.
Any nurse who fails to report to work as directed above will be dismissed by the county governments and the Ministry of Health. The respective county governments will therefore be at liberty to undertake any action as they deem appropriate against personnel who fail to resume duty as directed by the Employment and Labour Relations Court. We cannot allow unlawful industrial action to derail us from our focus of taking Kenya forward.
Last week, the court ordered nurses to suspend the strike for at least 60 days and give room for negotiations, an order that the nurses ignored, prompting action from the head of state. President Kenyatta says he has ordered the police to take action on the nurses who might harass their colleagues who are on duty.
All nurses should resume duty with effect and in any case, not later than Friday, the 15th of February, 2019, at 8 a.m. Number two, as a commander-in-chief of the Kenya Defense Forces, I have instructed the National Police Service to take stern action against those picketeers who may intimidate or otherwise harass public servants who intend to go to work.
Nurses have paralyzed health services in public hospitals for the second week now as efforts to have them avert the strike hit rocks. However, the Kenya Union of Nurses Secretary General Seth Panyako maintains that the strike is legal and that the notices were issued.
The strike is ongoing. I have read 13 employers. Strike is on. Nothing has changed. There are others who are beginning on Monday. I said that. There are others beginning on Tuesday next week. I said that. And as a union, if I start to be challenged and to go into starting to make political statements in matters of workers, then I'll be deviating from my core mandate. I'll also be engaging in political gimmicks because the Council of Governors is not an association mandated by law to act on behalf of any employer in Kenya.
President Kenyatta's threats comes at a time when the clinical officers have threatened to go on strike from 16th of this month as laboratory technicians issue 21-day strike notice. One of President Kenyatta's big four agenda is universal health care, which in the recent past has been marred with demonstrations and ghost loo. Reporting for VOA's Daybreak Africa, I am Maureen Ojiambo in Nairobi, Kenya.
This week, Cameroon authorities charged Maurice Kamto in a military tribunal with rebellion, insurrection, and hostility against the homeland. Kamto claimed to have won last October's presidential election. He accused President Paul Biya of stealing the results. He was arrested January 28 after organizing a rally against the Biya government. 22 members of CAMTO's Cameroon Renaissance Movement Party are also on trial for the same charges. Professor Patrice Nanga of New York's Stony Brook University heads the campaign to free Maurice CAMTO. He says the charges against Mr. CAMTO are politically motivated.
The fluency in English is vital. It's actually a legal requirement for a person in a holding office of that high rank to be conversant and fluent in English. Because after all, you have to have a minimum of a secondary school certificate in order to qualify for nomination as a vice president or president, or for that matter, for a member of parliament.
So why do you suppose that he was chosen if he's not that fluent? Let's remember now that English is the official language of Malawi.
I do believe that there is a strategy. The fluency in English is vital. It's actually a legal requirement for a person in a holding office of that high rank to be conversant and fluent in English, because after all, you have to have a minimum of a secondary school certificate in order to qualify for nomination as a vice president or president, or for that matter, for a member of parliament.
So why do you suppose that he was chosen if he's not that fluent? Let's remember now that English is the official language of Malawi.
I do believe that there is a strategy here that is not obvious at the moment. Indeed, it has led to much puzzlement and scratching of heads.
What do you mean? The comment I'm hearing also is that his appointment or his selection to be the vice presidential candidate for President Mutharika has caused somewhat of a split within the ruling party?
Yes, I wouldn't call it a split. I think it has heightened tensions and divisions and factions within the party. The reason for that is that there are actually four vice presidents in the party, one for each region, the North, the center, the south, and the east. All of them had an eye on that post, but the vice president from the southern region, who comes from the same ethnic tribe as the incumbent president, was pretty confident of getting that position, and indeed, to all the extents and purposes, was gearing himself for that role.
What are people saying in terms of why President Mutharika picked Mr. Chimulerenji? What is the discussion there?
What I'm saying, that there is much puzzlement regarding that decision, because the nominee is deemed to be a political lightweight. He was the governor of a district called Ncheu in the central region 3 years ago. He was appointed to cabinet 3 months ago. He is not reckoned as a political heavyweight. And within the DPP, you have got some very powerful people who actually feel let down or betrayed at having been passed over.
To Mr. Chimulerenji's defense, there are those who say even the former president, Bakary Muluzi, he spoke broken English.
Well, I beg to differ. In fact, the previous president, Dr. Bakary Muluzi, was a people's person. He had the charisma which used to extend to all and sundry rank and file. And when he held a meeting, he could sway that crowd like very few others. And his fluency certainly was not lacking.
Adawo Rafik Hajjar, the executive director of the Institute for Policy Interaction, he was speaking with me from Malawi's capital, Lilongwe. There is tension in the air as Nigeria prepares to vote in Saturday's presidential election. Incumbent President Muhammadu Buhari, who is 76 years old, of the ruling All Progressive Congress Party, and former Vice President Atiku Abubakar of the opposition People's Democratic Party are the leading candidates. But young people could decide the results of the election. Over 60% of Nigeria's 84 million registered voters are 18 to 35 years old, and some analysts say the youth vote could be decisive. VOA's Peter Clote, who is covering the Nigerian elections, sat down with Ezekiel Kuni, the spokesman of the Northern Nigeria Youth Organization.
The organization is sensitizing with youths. As you can go by the name, NNYO is sensitizing with the youths. Let the youth shun violence. Let the youth see election. Let it not be a do-or-die affair. We are looking at a position where the youth should fully participate and elect a credible person, a credible leader to lead them, not to be used as thugs. We also feel that we should participate fully. As in the northern Nigerian youth, we are particular on the northern part of the nation. It is non-political, it is non-partisan, it is non-religious organization.
So far, ahead of this election, what has your organization been doing in the way of sensitization? Give me specific things that you have done to encourage the youth to participate in this election. Because some of them are saying they are not reaping any benefit from the system, so why should they go and vote at all?
In reality, every program that comes is not everybody that participates and gets a share of it. But we, from our organization, we feel that the youth should take part. The youth should be active in election that is coming. We have taken the campaign to several states. We have organized seminars to where we will see that the youths go out in mass and collect their PVC, which is the permanent voter's card. And now if they collect it, that is the power of voting. That is the power of their leadership that you decide at this point in time. We have done such sensitizations in so many communities, mentioned Kano State, mentioned Jigawa State, mentioned Taraba State. Here in Lagos, we have done that with our small communities like visiting Agege, Alimosho, and some other communities to sensitize with the youths. And it came out in a well-recognized mass.
Let me ask you this, because people have expressed concern that the youth are sometimes used by some of these political leaders to intimidate and harass opponents so they prevent their supporters from going to the polls to vote.
This is not new, because over some time this has been happening, and it is the reason why we came on board, to make sure that the youths are not used as thugs, to make sure that the youths are not there just to vote for the money's sake. They are not there for any other purpose but to elect a credible leader. And the youth should shun violence. That's our gospel. We are preaching it, that every youth should see it that is his or her own civil right to vote and to do the proper thing, not to be used by any political leader as a thug or for any reason.
That was Ezekiel Kunin, the spokesman of the Northern Nigerian Youth Organization. He spoke with viewers Peter Clotty, who is covering the Nigerian election. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Thursday, February 14. Daybreak Africa time is 17 minutes past the hour. In the Gambia, a senior army captain has emerged as the first witness to confess before the country's Truth and Reconciliation Commission, the TRC, about his role in torturing a former agriculture minister under former President Saldauda Jawara's rule. Captain Boubacar Barr, an active serving member of Gambia's military, confessed that he was the soldier who broke Omar Amadou Diallo's eye back in October of 1995. Pandere Umbaye reports.
Captain Boubacar Barr says he was in his 20s when the incident happened. He says he tortured Omar Amadou Diallo, a former agriculture minister under Jawara's rule, based on what he called misleading information he received from one of his colleagues, the late Alma Momane, about Jallo's alleged plans to overthrow the former military junta.
He started to explain to me that OJ is conniving with the Europeans. You know, that time there was sanction embargo against the Gambia. And then, you know, he's working on modalities to bring mercenaries into the Gambia. And then they will overthrow the new government, and then they will spoil the revolution. And in the process, the mercenaries who are mercenaries, they will end up also killing all of us.
Captain Barr says he was young and gullible at the time. He then descended on the former minister and started torturing him. Diallo lost one of his eyes during the process.
As I came close to him, I punched him on the stomach. You know, I hit him on the stomach, then he bent down, and then I started beating him with my hands. So suddenly, you know, because Fajara Barracks was the headquarters of the gendarmerie, then when I look around, I was not satisfied with hitting and kicking him with my hands and my feet. I saw that, you know, these truncheons that were being used by the gendarmes, for some reason, I don't know, they were littered around.
Captain Bass says he had regretted his past actions. He has apologized to Omar Amar Diallo, his family, and the Gambian nation for his callous actions against the former minister. He says the torture he inflicted on Diallo had tormented him over the years.
The reasons why I couldn't face him to apologize him that time were two reasons. One is that person under whose rule these things happened was still the president of the Republic of the country that time. And when you go to apologize, one, you don't know how he is, one, you don't know how the person you are apologizing is going to react. One. Number two, also, you don't know how also, under whose watch you did this thing also is going to react.
Ba was arrested during Gambia's month-long political impasse back in December of 2016. He says his arrest had to do with his refusal to firebomb petrol stations located in the Greater Banjul area. He says he was given orders by General Saul Badi, a close confidant of dictator Jame, to engage in such sabotage activities, but he refused. The goal for the sabotage, he says, was to attribute it to the opposition, so that Jame can arrest them. Bass torture victim Omar Amar Diallo says he had forgiven all those who had tortured him during Jame's rule.
And I want people to know that we are all believers. For me, I have said, all those who tortured me, all those who did these bad things to me, I've forgiven them. What they have done to my prophet is worse than what they did to me. What they did to Prophet Isa is worse than what they did to me. What they did to Prophet Abraham is worse than what they did for me.
Meanwhile, Laminwa Juara, a former staunch opponent of dictator Jame's rule, also appeared before the commission on Wednesday. Juara testified that he had been arrested and tortured on numerous occasions during Jame's rule. For VOA Daybreak Africa, this is Pandirimba reporting.
This week, Cameroon authorities charged Maurice Kamto in a military tribunal with rebellion, insurrection, and hostility against the homeland. Kamto claimed to have won last October's presidential election. He accused President Paul Biya of stealing the results. He was arrested January 28 after organizing a rally against the Biya government. 22 members of Kamto's Cameroon Renaissance Movement Party are also on trial for the same charges. Professor Patrice Ngana of New York's Stony Brook University heads the campaign to free Maurice Kamto. He says the charges against Mr. Kamto are politically motivated.
The government is charging him with a couple of ridiculous charges, I will say. The first is rebellion. The second is hostility à la patrie, or hostility to the fatherland. Those are the most important charges that are on the table. But they haven't been voiced yet, to tell you the truth. So we are still waiting for the formal announcement of the charges because they were brought to jail to await their trial.
Kamto came second in the election. So how does he get to be charged with rebellion, insurrection, and hostility against the homeland?
The first sentence you say that he came second is disputed. And that is where the story begins, because he actually came first. You see, the results of that election are totally disputed, and it is the basic contention here. First of all, because one part of the country did not go to vote at all, and now the president who is in power, Paul Biya, claims to have won by 100% in places where people did not vote at all. Then you have lots of constituencies where people voted for Kamto, where actually Kamto won according to his own tallies, and President Biya says he won. So you have a contentious election where Kamto says he won, and Biya says that he won and stays in the palace. And going from there, Maurice Kamto started a campaign of national resistance, calling the All Cameroonians and specifically his militants to resist and establish a platform of actions, one of which was to protest on the street. So on the 26th of January,
across the globe, and specifically in Douala and in Yaoundé. In Douala, he walked on the street and he was arrested the next day. And now the accusation of the government is that the people who worked in France, in Germany, ransacked the embassies of Cameroon there. And they are charging Kamto with masterminding the ransacking of the Cameroon embassy in France and in Germany and of protesting on the street in Douala.
You said that he started a resistance movement, is that correct?
Yes, it is. There are many stories going on in Cameroon now, one of which is that one part of Cameroon picked up guns against the government, and these are English-speaking Cameroonians. Mr. Kamto is a Francophone, and he runs, so far, the largest political party.
So you can understand, from the government point of view, why they would be charging him with rebellion if he started a resistance movement.
Yeah, but he's not the one who started the rebellion movement in the Anglophone part. He's totally disconnected from that. So the people who started the Ambazonians, these are separate groups. They are totally independent groups. They don't have anything to do with him. And the charges that are labeled on him are independent of what is going on in the English-speaking part of Cameroon.
So Mr. Kamto started a non-violent resistance.
Exactly. He started a non-violent resistance. And it is important to underline that because his platform, his program, everything he stands for has always been non-violent. And indeed, he rebuked any person who stood for violence.
He's been charged in the military tribunal. What's next?
What is amazing is, first of all, the fact that he was tried by the military tribunal. Although he is a civilian, a lawyer himself, he could not see a lawyer, you know, before he was brought before the military tribunal. So he's charged by the military tribunal, although he actually advocated for peace, he advocated for non-violent participation in elections and for the rule of law, and he actually rebuked anybody who spoke of violence.
Professor, thank you very much for speaking with us on Daybreak Africa.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Professor Patrice Nanga heads the campaign to free Cameroon opposition leader Maurice Kamto. You are speaking with me from New York's Stony Brook University. A new report finds the world's unemployment rate has dropped to 5%, the lowest level since the global economic crisis in 2008. The International Labour Organization reports the jobs being created, however, are poor quality jobs that keep most of the world's workers mired in poverty. Lisa Schlein reports.
Slightly more than 172 million people globally were unemployed in 2018. That is about 2 million less than the previous year. The International Labour Organization expects the global unemployment rate of 5% to remain essentially unchanged over the next few years. The ILO report finds the majority of the 3.3 billion people employed throughout the world, though, are working under poor conditions that do not guarantee them a decent living. ILO Deputy Director General for Policy, Deborah Greenfield, says many people have jobs that do not offer them economic security, lack material well-being, and decent work opportunities.
These jobs tend to be informal and characterized by low pay, insecurity, and little or no access to social protection and rights at work. Worldwide, 2 billion workers, or 61%, were in informal employment.
Over the past 30 years, the report finds a great decline in working poverty in middle-income countries, but the situation remains serious in low- and middle-income countries.
That was viewers Lisa Schlein reporting from Geneva. That is it for this Thursday, February 14th edition of Daybreak Africa. Join us again tomorrow for more Africa news and features right here on the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as sports editor Samson O'Malley, along with our engineer John Ellison, I'm James Butte in Washington, wishing you in Africa a very good day.
Hello, peepsters. Welcome to the weekend. I'm Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Boy, do I have a show for you. 55 minutes of cool, commercial-free, Pan-African music. Hear your
your favorite current Afro beats. Discover new music from Ghana and meet Blinky Bill from Nairobi. He's just released a new album.
Even if you know a lot of things, there's no guarantee that you're going to see it tomorrow.
Revel in earthy African classics from Mali, Cape Verde, DRC, and South Africa. All this and more this Sunday at 15:05 and 20:05 UTC. Just tune in to your local FM station and meet me there. Music Time in Africa.